business class. What's been going on?
The trick is not to be on staff. that'll mean more to Times listeners than they will to average listeners. But I'm not actually on the Times staff.
But John, all right. So you've been doing this as a freelancer, but how have you got away with what appears to have been an experience several times of being on private jets? What's been going on there?
Private jets actually is interesting because they are kind of business stories. So you'll find governments trying to tax. You're trying to find governments trying to tax them. And also, actually, weirdly, the other thing I should say is that readers who don't normally like you writing about fancy things, so if you write about an expensive watch or dress in the fashion pages, they complain because it's all ridiculous. But they absolutely love private jets and first-class travel. They don't complain at all. In fact, they want more. The more ridiculous things you can do in first class, the more interested they are. And I think it's because we all dream of sort of, you know, one day making it, you know, through the curtain. What? Making it to the pointy end and just enjoying all of this, and maybe that one day that will happen. But you can write, honestly, you can write almost anything about private jets or first class. And
John, I'm sure your stories of first class could go on forever. A man who only turns left when he gets onto a plane. John Arledge, it's been a pleasure to have you on Times at One. Thank you very much, but I have had to interrupt you because we are pretty much out of time. That's it for today's edition of the Times at One. I'll be back tomorrow, but it's Fee and Rosie next. Stay
across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Stephen. Your luxury audio travel continues. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright here on Times Radio.
Coming up on the show today, the Prime Minister backs his health secretary just hours after claims he was plotting a leadership challenge. We'll speak to Starmer's former political director. British spy agencies are withholding intel on suspected drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean following concerns over the US's strikes in the region. New research suggests alpacas could be the key to treating brain disorders like Alzheimer's. We'll find out why. And our big guest today is Katie Prescott, the Times technology business editor, speaking about her new book, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch.
We hope you can stay with us until four. Let's get the latest news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, V. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer said he did not authorise briefings against his cabinet. It's as he faced Prime Minister's questions amid speculation over his future as leader.
Mr. Speaker, he's talking about growth and investment. While the Prime Minister desperately tries to cling on to his own job, perhaps he understands what it's like for all those people out there losing their jobs. How can he talk about growth? Yesterday, we learned that unemployment has risen to the same rate as it was in lockdown. 180,000 jobs lost, Mr. Speaker. Why does the Prime Minister think that unemployment has risen every single month since Labour took office?
That was the leader of the opposition, Kemi Badenoch, but Sir Keir Starmer defended the government's record on tackling unemployment.
Let me give the House the details. 329,000 people more are in work since the start of this year. So 329,000 more are in work. Of course I accept we need to do more in relation to unemployment.
Decades of abuse of thousands of young men by staff at County Durham Detention Centre were ignored and dismissed by the Prison Service, Police and Home Office. That's the main finding by the Prisons and Probation Ombudsman after looking into the Medamsley Detention Centre. The sexual and physical abuse took place between 1961 and 1987. Eric Sampson was sent there aged 17.
The violence I had done to me was terrible. The amount of times I was knocked about, every day was hell on earth. Every day and night was hell on earth for the full 9.5 weeks. With all the abuse and the obviously, the sexual abuse I had done to us, it totally ruined my life.
Well, Durham police have apologised and say victims remain the primary concern. Thousands of job cuts at the NHS will go ahead after £1 billion for redundancies was approved by the Treasury. The government had already announced its intention to slash 18,000 administrative and managerial roles across NHS England and the Department of Health. West Streeting says it'll free up funds for frontline services.
So within the next 2 years, NHS England will have been completely abolished. And over the course of the next 3 years, we will have halved those organisations. The work to reduce the size of ICBs, my department and NHS England, is beginning immediately with a voluntary redundancy programme.
Seven men have been charged with more than 40 offences against 11 teenagers after an investigation into child sexual exploitation in Bristol. The alleged offences took place between 2022 and this year. And Donald Trump has doubled down on his legal threat to the BBC, saying he has an obligation to sue the corporation for $1 billion. It's over the controversial edit of the speech he gave before the US Capitol riot. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Thanks, Eliza. It's 4 minutes past two. Welcome aboard then. It's Wednesday, or is it Wednesday? We're going to unpack the very latest, I'm so sorry, on how secure the Prime Minister is after a rather frantic 24 hours of Westminster's favourite game. Is a leadership challenge coming? Where does it leave the main players this afternoon? We also like to have a bit of light and shade on the show. So straight after we talk about Wes Streeting's future, it's alpaca news. This is a brilliant story about how the animals are helping in the fight against Alzheimer's. In TV with Scott Bryan, we always do that on a Wednesday. We talk about who might be the next Director General at the BBC and also what's good to watch on TV this week. And after 3 o'clock, John Bird, the founder of The Big Issue, joins us to talk about how our attitudes to helping the homeless have changed. And we'd be very interested in your thoughts about that one. 0333 003 2353. Are you one of the increasing number of people who simply walk past the Big Issue sellers? And obviously there is an uncomfortable but necessary conversation to be had about a cashless society and what that does to people who used to take the odd 50p or pound coin or 20p that you would throw into a hat, particularly in the winter and at this time of year. In tech news with Chris Stokel-Walker, we're going to talk about cyber security. And who is our guest after 3:30 today, Rosie?
Katie Prescott, the Times Technology Business Editor, who has written this brilliant book, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch. That name might not be familiar to you, but I will jog your memory by talking of the tragic sinking of the Bayesian yacht last summer. And Mike Lynch has had this completely extraordinary career from very sort of austere, quite humble beginnings, really became known as the British alternative to Bill Gates. And he was, the story is quite, it's sort of out of the plot you would imagine of Succession. He was tried for fraud. He had a 0.4% chance of winning and defeating that fraud conviction, which he did. And it was then when celebrating the fact that he'd won that court case and wasn't going to spend the rest of his life behind jail, behind bars in a US jail, that his boat sunk and his co-defendant, the very same weekend, was killed in a road accident in Cambridge. That the odds of those two individuals dying on the same weekend in such freak accidents is four in one billion rather than the way around. Basically, it was so unbelievably unlikely. And Katie has charted this story with amazing detail and with huge difficulty, actually, because some of his colleagues, Mike Lynch's colleagues, had said, Katie Prescott is dangerous. Don't talk to her. So it was a real challenge, actually, to pen this story. And she'll tell us exactly the route she caved out to try and do exactly that a little bit later.
It is a fascinating story. And I think we all want to attach more to the coincidence of those deaths than actually either of those really sad cases should allow us to do, because the co-defendant died in a road accident. There was, a woman who was driving over a humpback bridge, didn't see the man jogging. And of course, it was a storm that took down the Bayesian. May have been contributing factors on the yacht. But people want to make something of that coincidence, don't they, in a very dark way.
And the other challenge Katie had in telling this story was weaving her way through the numerous conspiracy theories about that, because people thought it can't be coincidence.
Absolutely.
But it was just a desperately sad coincidence. So Katie will tell us that story at 3:30.
Most read stories on the Times website today, please, Rosie Wright.
Yes, let's have a look. So kicking off at number three, Starmer's allies have just emboldened restive MPs to find an alternative. The Times' Patrick McGuire says Number 10 hoped to smoke out Wes Streeting, the Health Secretary. Instead, and if you were listening to Times Radio Breakfast this morning and Wes Streeting himself, briefings from advisers have backfired and weakened the Prime Minister's position. The second most read story, we got a glimpse of this yesterday, how pub staff finally rumbled a cheating quiz team. Workers at the Barking Dog in Manchester watched carefully when the same middle-aged team won their quiz every single week. It was not subtle duplicity. And the most read piece on the Times website is Starmer backs Wes Streeting at Prime Minister's questions after that briefing war. That is the Times live politics page where you can get all the latest news on the, well, latest row at the very top of government. Patrick said this morning they haven't finished completing the last row before they've now started the next. You can, of course, read all those articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Well, we've got a terrific guest on the Wes Streeting story. Just a very quick reminder, in case you're just joining us this afternoon, Keir Starmer has backed his health secretary less than a day after Downing Street accused him of plotting to take over. Wes Streeting wasn't at PMQs to hear this endorsement from his boss.
Let me be absolutely clear. Any attack on any member of my cabinet is completely unacceptable. On the health secretary, Mr. Speaker, in relation to health secretary, he promised before the election that in the first year of a Labour government, we'd deliver 2 million extra appointments. We didn't deliver 2 million, or three, or four. We delivered 5 million extra appointments. And today, the health secretary is in Manchester, where he's announcing that because of the action he's taken to abolish NHS England, he's putting more people on the front line. He's doing a great job, as is the whole of my cabinet.
It was a particularly rowdy one today. Let's talk to Luke Sullivan, who was Keir Starmer's political director until he entered government. A very good afternoon from us, Luke. I mean, the bottom line here is it's not ideal to have to praise someone your team say is trying to overthrow you. What do you think has gone on here?
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. I mean, I think, as you've said in your introduction, this was a phenomenal scoop from the impeccably well-sourced Patrick McGuire that broke this story yesterday evening. And then there was a flurry of other journalists who had their own versions of it. And it really has set the agenda for today. And look, I think the Prime Minister did exactly what he needed to do. He sought to shut this down in as strong and robust a way as he humanly possibly could. He's absolutely right to back Wes Streeting, but he was also absolutely clear that this briefing doesn't come and wasn't sanctioned or authorised by him.
Would it be fair to say that it set the agenda because people want it to be so? They want it to be true, actually. They want to entertain the idea that a strong candidate is going to come forward and nudge out an incumbent whose poll ratings are on the floor.
No, I don't think that's the case. I think what has made this so surprising and taken people aback in Westminster and why it's led broadcast bulletins, you know, late last night and throughout today, is that the source of this seems to have come from people in and around the Prime Minister. Now, I think what has happened, whoever thought this was a good idea, it has clearly backfired. I think you could tell from the Prime Minister that he was furious with this, that this is not something that he backed or sanctioned. You know, the Prime Minister does not conduct his politics in this way. He hates these personal private briefings. He, you know, when I used to work with him, he would tear his hair out when things like this happened. He's obviously had to address it, and Kemi Badenoch had some fun with the Prime Minister.
What have people within Westminster said to you about the origins of this then? Obviously, we're not expecting you to provide us with any names, but you could certainly provide us with a bit more insight, I suspect.
Look, I think there are obviously a lot of suggestions on the rumour mill of who these came from. I think what is...
Go on, add to them, Luke.
Well, no, and I'm not going to get into baseless speculation, but I think the point to make is this... It doesn't look like it was a rogue briefing by one individual who's got a bit overexcited. You know, this was, you know, the most senior political journalists in the land receiving a briefing. And that was why, you know, not only the Times broke it, the Guardian had a version of the story, I think Bloomberg and the BBC. These are very senior, well-sourced political editors and journalists who do not write stories like this, you know, based on tittle-tattle.
Sure.
And that's what's been a surprising thing over this last sort of 12 hours or so.
And how do you think all of this leaves Wes Streeting's reputation and appearance today?
Yeah, I think Wes clearly showed why he's regarded as one of the best political communicators, not just of this government, but in the UK. And I think last night when the news broke and people clocked that he was on the morning round, actually speaking about a really good news story for this government about the steps they've been taking on to get waiting lists down, to put resources into the front line on the NHS, how would he deal with it? And I think, you know, there's no denying he smashed it out of the park. He clearly navigated a really tricky political situation. And as you said, he wasn't at PMQs today. That's because he's out giving a speech, I think, to the NHS Confederation, where he's talking about the NHS plans to put more, to get these waiting lists
down. He's in Manchester, isn't he? I mean, he is very fluent in normal speak. He can do a traitor's reference, and I think it's believable, Luke, if a little bit. I've rehearsed this a lot in the Mirror this morning, and I think a lot of people think if Keir Starmer does that, it doesn't sound very believable. And also, he hasn't been in the country for most of the traitor's series anyway. So what would your advice be to Keir Starmer to try and bridge that reality and believability gap?
I think what a lot of us who want the Prime Minister, and I have no doubt that the whole Cabinet want the Prime Minister and his Labour government to succeed, what they want to see is he gave a really good speech at conference. He had a good week, partly because of the circumstances around the Andy Burnham interest, but he gave a good speech. And yes, it's right that he's out representing the UK abroad on the global stage, but he also needs to get out and find a way of connecting with voters by, you know, being part more politically and be giving press conferences. I think that's one of the things people want to see, is the Prime Minister out explaining what this government is doing, why it's having to make the difficult choices. And look, in 2 weeks' time, we will be analysing and trying to work out the effects, both on people hitting their pockets, but also the political ramifications of what is, you know, likely to be the most politically consequential budget of definitely my lifetime, when Rachel gives that in 2 weeks' time.
And you're so right about that. I mean, it's going to be an event that really does touch on so many people's lives. Surely the problem increasingly for Keir Starmer is if Wes Streeting comes out of something like this looking great, then everybody after the budget is as interested in what the Health Secretary has to say, if not more so, than what the Prime Minister has to say. And we won't be playing whack-a-mole, we'll be playing whack-a-wes, won't we? When's he going to pop up again?
Look, I think that, and that ultimately goes to whoever thought this briefing was a good idea. And I think it has backfired. And, you know, essentially something where I do not believe there was a plot to take out the Prime Minister is now being received as, you know, as wisdom. And people are having this conversation on broadcast, both on radio and TV. And that is a pretty extraordinary own goal.
Yeah. Do you think that Morgan McSweeney might exit the quite well-oiled revolving exit door of Downing Street sometime soon?
Look, I thought the Prime Minister was really clear in his defence of not just Morgan, but of the whole team. And I think ultimately he takes, the Prime Minister, Keir, takes responsibility for everything that goes on in his team. Look, Morgan has clearly been a huge part of the success, not just of helping to get Keir elected as the leader of the opposition, but also the historic general election win. And I have no doubt that if this Labour government, it has had a tricky first 15 months, but all of the individuals in and around the Prime Minister will have to play their part and are playing their part to try and deliver. And look, there's understandable that people ask these questions, but like ultimately the only individual who can answer that was the Prime Minister. And I thought he gave really clear, firm position on that.
OK. Do you really believe that, actually, Luke? I mean, you know, the shouts and screams from the benches in the House of Commons, I mean, they're always quite telling aren't they? And as he was saying that, you just know that people were laughing at that response. And that is difficult, isn't it? When that level of cynicism enters a reply to an important question, it is troubling for everybody.
Look, there's no denying that in politics, actually the most dangerous thing is ridicule and people laughing at you. And look, the chamber is a circus. It's a pantomime. It's a performance. It's very performative. And obviously, look, there's got huge difficulties and issues that this Labour government are trying to navigate. But I do think that actually this Labour government is doing a lot of good things. And frankly, what we should have been talking about today, and I'm clear the Prime Minister will be absolutely furious that we're ending up talking about this, not the huge health announcement that Wes made, that that's how this government is going to prove that it deserves to win the next election and to have the faith of the British public.
Well, I tell you what, if they're listening in Downing Street this afternoon, Luke Sullivan, they'll be delighted to know that we're moving on from this interview to talk about alpacas in just a couple of moments' time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Luke Sullivan, who was Keir Starmer's political director.
It just seems like an extraordinary own goal, doesn't it? And then you give Wes Streeting, like I said, if he does the morning round interviews, you feel almost a bit of relief if I'm covering the breakfast show or listening in, because you think, oh, he's actually going to answer. I'm going to hear actually what Wes thinks. And I think he's handled it very deftly this morning, to the misfortune then of the Prime Minister. Well, as promised, coming up, we will discuss the latest of the many gifts alpacas offer us. It is 20 minutes past two. This is Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, sitting in this week for Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Lots to cover on the programme as ever. We'll bring you all the news and views from 6 o'clock. We'll react to the GDP figures. We're also going to do a story about Hitler's genetics. I'll say no more than that.
Mysterious as ever, Stig Abel. And Times columnist Hannah Betts and historian Peter Frankopan will join us to talk through the news of the day. Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mum was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working. Wind, yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar, know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Bathrooms, the experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wickes Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
22 minutes past two. Now, it was news to me, Fee's quite affinity for alpacas. But if we didn't think alpacas were giving us enough already simply by existing, a new study has found they could potentially be the key to treating some human brain disorders, disorders like schizophrenia, Alzheimer's. Research found that antibody-like compounds called nanobodies, which are found in camelids, that was also new to me today, like llamas and alpacas, could revolutionise how neurological conditions are treated. The neuroscientist Sabrina Brennan is with us. Sabrina, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing? Yes, camelid was the first time I'd heard it today as well. Camelid. I had to look up how to pronounce it.
Well, thank you for correcting me. Why don't you tell us all then, what is a camelid? Shall we start there?
It's just the family that llamas, alpacas, camels belong to. But the reason they're part of this story is that these animals naturally produce a simplified type of antibody, which is made of a single chain, which scientists can isolate and adapt into nanobodies for medicine. And the reason that's important in the context of brain diseases is one of the biggest challenges for treating brain disease is the blood-brain barrier. That serves us really, really well in that the brain is very vulnerable to viruses and toxins. And so it's like a security checkpoint that prohibits viruses and those kind of things from getting through to the brain. So it's really good in terms of protecting us. But that presents a problem in terms of treating brain diseases because things like antibodies are too big to get through the blood-brain barrier. So they're kind of a Y-shaped protein. But these nanobodies are about a tenth of the size of a regular antibody. And so that's why they represent, you know, a potential breakthrough in terms of treating brain diseases, as you said, like schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases.
That word potential is so important, isn't it? Because we can hear stories like this and get excited. What do you think it actually tells us in how we might be able to treat these conditions in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very important because one of my pet hates is when the news runs away with, you know, what is in this case, very, very early research. It's, you know, proof of concept research. It's preclinical. It's not being tested in humans. And in fact, it's a long, long way away from that. But the mere fact that it can cross the blood-brain barrier is a big sort of step up. And that's where the potential is. There's a possibility that they can go through what's called fenestrated vessels, which is tiny blood vessels near the brain that have little windows or pores. And so that, you know, has potential, but hasn't been tested in Alzheimer's disease. In fact, I think much of it has been in the early research has been in schizophrenia. Yes, it has potential, but probably a long way off. You know, there's thoughts that they can also maybe use it as gene therapy. So instead of injecting the drug, doctors would give cells the instructions to make nanobodies themselves. And also there's a possibility with these nanobodies that they could be used to gently tune the activity of brain receptors rather than, switching them on or off, which is what often happens, you know, with certain treatments. It's like it's sort of turning the volume, using a dimmer switch rather than an on-off switch. And the real potential, I suppose the real kind of good news is any treatment so far, there's been huge risk of serious side effects. So that may be less of a risk with these nanobodies. But it's exciting. It has potential, but nothing in the very immediate future.
Sabina, does harm have to come to an alpaca for these nanobodies to be of use?
I don't believe they've been actually researching, doing the research on the alpacas themselves. It's the fact that these camelids, I'm seeing the spelling.
New I looked to up. All of us.
K-U-H-A-L-I-D, camelids. They inspired the research. Basically, this is a proof of concept that if you have, you know, these nanobodies, can they pass through and treat? So the research has been, as it usually is, done in rodents to date.
Okay. So I can carry on dreaming of my alpaca farm, safe in the knowledge that people aren't going to come along and harm my alpacas in the name of science. Why would scientists have turned to the camelids for this kind of knowledge?
Gosh, that's a rather interesting question, and I'll put my hands up. I don't honestly know the answer. I mean, obviously, you know, for decades and decades, people have been looking for ways to treat what is, you know, one of our most devastating diseases, Alzheimer's disease, with little success in terms of treatment. So, you know, often these things happen by happenstance, you know, where someone discovers something about an animal, because apparently these camelids are the only ones who produce these, naturally produce these nanobodies. I think there's a certain type of fish also do it. So I suppose that's unusual in itself. And I would imagine that someone thought, oh my goodness, well, these are small enough, you know, that we might be able to use them for blood-brain barrier. But that's me speculating, because I honestly don't know the answer. And I always put my hands up if I don't.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Alzheimer's, how do we currently treat it? It is, you know, you described it, it's so devastating. All of us will have family, friends impacted, yes, impacted by it. It feels as though in this sort of world of medicine that can be so revolutionary, that there just hasn't been the breakthrough that we are so desperately searching for.
Yes, but that's in terms of pharmacology. So, I mean, my whole work, my whole area is in terms of brain health and encouraging people to adopt a brain healthy lifestyle, because what we do know, whilst we can't cure the disease, we can draw a distinction between the Alzheimer's pathology that's in your brain, so the beta amyloid plaques and the tangles, and the symptoms, which are dementia. And we know that if you adopt a brain healthy lifestyle, that you can build up what's known as cognitive reserves or brain reserves, which sort of, they almost make the brain resilient to the Alzheimer's pathology. So essentially, in the early stages of the disease, it's not about how much disease pathology you have in your brain, it's about how much healthy brain you have to cope with that disease. Now, over time, then eventually, you know, you will run out of healthy brain and you will manifest symptoms. But this research goes right back to 1986. There's been a lot of research on it. And really what happened was this guy called Katzman in the mid 80s was looking at the slices of brains post-mortem of individuals who had a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease in a nursing home and individuals of the same age who had no diagnosis. And he discovered 10 cases of cognitively normal individuals in his control group who had sufficient pathology in their brain for a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And over the years, what we've discovered is that that resilience comes from lifestyle factors. And those brain healthy lifestyle factors also kind of are almost opposites of what we know are modifiable risk factors for dementia. So, you know, what's good for your heart is good for your brain. Your brain needs a really healthy cardiovascular system to feed your brain the oxygen and nutrients it needs. Poor cardiovascular health in terms of fitness, physical fitness, and you know, high blood pressure, those kind of things increase your risk of developing dementia.
So it sounds as though, Sabrina, sorry, just for time, that it is the basics, it's the exercise, sleep and diet that help
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Yeah, and no smoking, and watch the alcohol, you know, all the healthy stuff.
The things we know about. Yeah, Sabrina, thank you very much. Sabrina Brennan, the neuroscientist, really appreciate your time. There is a friend of yours, it sounds like, Fee, on the text from Tracy.
Well, Tracy says alpacas are the gentlest of ungulates. They make excellent guard dogs and are the most intuitive and calming of creatures. They just know. Tracy of Cambridgeshire is a woman after my own heart. My Instagram feed consists entirely of fitted sheets, alpacas and Elizabeth Day, and I'm happier because of it. Oh, this is an alpaca from Ryan. You see? Just, they are the laughing camelids. Thank you. Thank you. The UK suspends some intelligence sharing with the United States. Will Donald Trump forgive us? That is going to happen after we get the latest news update. Our apologies. A couple of minutes later, it's gone 2:30. Here's Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thanks, Lee. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister insists his team is united
That's despite briefings against the Health Secretary. Wes Streeting has criticised a toxic culture in Number 10 and called whispers that he was going to make a challenge for the top job as completely untrue. Sir Keir Starmer's told the House of Commons an attack on any member of his cabinet is completely unacceptable. Labour MP for Derby North, Catherine Atkinson, is backing the PM.
This is a distraction on what everyone needs to be pulling together to do. But I haven't seen any politicians who have come out saying that this is anything other than a united and stable government. And that is hugely important when we live in globally such uncertain times.
An inquiry has found staff at a detention centre in County Durham, where hundreds of young inmates suffered abuse, were either complicit or incompetent. The prison's ombudsman examined what happened at Mendemsley between 1961 and 1987. The Health Secretary is making a last-minute plea to resident doctors to call off their strike, but said the NHS would do everything it could to keep the show on the road. Wes Streeting is urging members of the British Medical Association to scrap their walkout. It's planned to start on Friday at 7 in the morning for 5 days. And a so-called cannibal storm is expected to hit Earth today. It could bring a dazzling Northern Lights display, but may also disrupt GPS navigation, communication systems and power grids. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 2:36. Fresh from his renewed backing by the Prime Minister, Wes Streeting has been speaking at a conference for NHS leaders this afternoon. He was asked if he still wanted to be Prime Minister one day, as he'd previously suggested.
I've got a harder job already, so I'm quite enjoying doing this one. Thank you very much. And I'm definitely not going to say anything today that adds to the silly season going on down south.
Okay, just final question on the manoeuvres that aren't. This morning on Sky News, you said that you felt that you'd been kneecapped by Downing Street in terms of the briefing.
I think I said it was the most unwarranted attack on a faithful since Joe Marler was banished in the traitors final. And I think whoever's been briefing this should spend a little less time watching celebrity traitors and a bit more time watching Country File.
He had the room with him, didn't he, when he made that joke? He also said the upcoming budget would be challenging, but praised the Chancellor for managing expectations.
You'd struggle to move to avoid the speculation about the budget and the expectation management, I think, that the Chancellor has been sensibly doing. This is going to be a challenging budget. We can see the economic backdrop and we can see the pressures on the public finances. I think we can be sure of a couple of things. The first is the Chancellor has been very clear that this is a budget to protect NHS investment. So I think we can go into the budget confident that what we were allocated, the spending review, is protected. If she can go further, especially on things like capital, I'm sure she will.
Well, I don't know about you, John Pienaar, but I just cannot wait for this budget to be upon us. I mean, it's like a kid counting down to Christmas now. It's just like, bring it on, please.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah. What is the extreme opposite of Christmas? It is like, it's like being sent into a dentist's chair. And so, actually, you're not going to be allowed out. Just get used to it. You're going to be there for a while. It's going to be horrible, the budget. And look at all of this leading up to it. I mean, you look at the story of what happened, you know, since this time yesterday, that amazing, astonishing briefing out of Downing Street. The Prime Minister is up for the fight. He'll take on all comers, and Wes Streeting in particular. You think, well, first of all, maybe there's a kind of a muscle memory reflex action. You think, well, I've never seen anything as bad as that. But then we can remember the circus of the Johnson premiership and the black comedy of Liz Truss and all of that sort of thing. But, you know, this, though, it's like a page out of the same book. How does this do anything except make a challenge to the Prime Minister? More, not less likely.
Yeah.
I mean, either he was simply not telling the truth when he was saying, look, it's quite wrong to brief against cabinet ministers, or his team is out of control. And maybe, look, either one's really deeply worrying. But the idea of a team out of control around the Prime Minister is things are just about to get wretchedly, wretchedly hard. My word.
Yeah, and we all enjoy talking about it as well.
Well, so. Of course. I mean, yeah, I mean, well, it's what we do, yeah. Isn't it? And but the sort of thing about a thing like this is, if there was such a thing as a normal response, maybe you'd imagine a Prime Minister to say, oh, this is just Westminster bubble gossip. You know, you lot love stirring it up. It's all good copy, makes a good listen. But this is about them pouring fuel on the fire and the idea of plotting against Starmer, which was just, you know, was I think there was a lot going on, wasn't there? But it was chatter, chatter, chatter. Now it's official. It's like a notice pinned to the door of number 10 Downing Street. So I'm going to be talking about that to our Times people. I'm talking to Gabriel Pongan on the latest gossip about Ariana Mihaila. But I'm talking to the Labour MP, Antonia Bance. I've been talking to the Secondary Care Minister, Karen Smyth, who I can tell you was desperate to change the subject, but it's not easy to change the subject on this.
You've also got some coverage, I know, about the latest emails that have been released by the US House Democrats, and these pertain to correspondence about President Trump between Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. Yeah. Now, this is quite big, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we're going to be talking about that. It's now sort of breaking now across the US networks and British networks as well. These emails, what do they say? How much deeper do they dig the hole? One of the emails was directed to Ghislaine Maxwell. He's serving time in a sort of low security prison, having spoken and seemingly got some sort of agreement with the Trump lawyers. But does this put her back into the heart of all of this? And will it get her any nearer to a pardon? And especially, more importantly, does it give Donald Trump more to worry about as he tries to make this whole thing go away? Democrats are so keen to keep on the case. So I'm going to be talking about that and finding out as much as we can.
John, thank you very much. John takes over from us at 4, runs through on Times Radio until 7.
Now, Britain has stopped sharing intelligence with the United States about suspected drug trafficking vessels in the Caribbean. The move follows growing concern over the legality of the Trump administration's lethal strikes on suspected drug smugglers. The Times reports that the UK agrees with the UN, which says those attacks are illegal. Bronwyn Maddox is director of the Chatham House think tank. Bronwyn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So tell us what has been going on in terms of the US administration's action and why it was that the UK thought, actually, we can't support this anymore.
Well, the US has been bringing increasing military force, including big naval vessels and small naval vessels to attack boats, it says, are being used by drug runners around the Caribbean. And the contest is whether this is legal or not, because they are going in many cases simply to kill these people. And the UK has very quietly, but it has surfaced in the past couple of days, partly thanks to the Times, has said, we are concerned that this is illegal. and we don't want to be involved. So we are going to step aside in the Caribbean from our normally extensive and rock-solid intelligence-sharing operation with the US, one of our closest allies, and we're just not going to help in it because we don't want to be accused of being complicit in what may be illegal action.
What has prompted this ramping up of action then from the United States? Because there had previously been quite a lot of cooperation between the US and the UK. I think it was September last year, the Royal Navy intercepted this sort of narco sub, seized £160 million worth of cocaine. That was an operation with the US. Why have the US amplified and accelerated their action in so sort of aggressively in the last few months?
There has been a flood of drugs into the US. Yes, it goes up and down, and these volumes are very large, but it is something the Trump administration has been particularly concerned about. They also are no friends of some of the governments involved, or not involved, but that they believe are not stopping this drug flow. And so they have chosen to ramp this up and have really very aggressively taken the action that I was describing with a stopping at sea of some of these vessels. And the UK has had some months to consider what to do about this, but has got increasingly uneasy.
We are friends with the US. You know, that so-called special relationship is much talked about. How damaging is it for the UK to say to the US, actually, sort of, we've reached a threshold of which we're not prepared to cross?
Do you know, we're in a very hard, realistic world. So even using the word friends these days in what is a very transactional world is not necessary, if I can put it that way. So I think the UK, in a way, can say, look, we don't agree with that bit. We are still very much your allies. We want to cooperate in lots and lots of things. But in a funny way, President Trump's transactionalism opens it up for others to respond in the same way. Now, he can get hurt and piqued by that in turn. And so it's not without risk for the UK to take this step. But I think we're seeing many countries and continents try and find new ways of dealing with the US and just explore whether, as the UK is now doing, you can side with it on many things, maintain a good personal relationship with President Trump, but say we're not with you on that particular bit.
When they weighed up the risks, what do you think they are in terms of repercussions or retaliation from Donald Trump?
The point is, you don't know. So there are all kinds of things at stake. There is the wider military intelligence cooperation. There is the US's continual, but under President Trump, rather edgy support for NATO. There is, though, the big trade relationship that the UK wants to have with the US, still not fleshed out, or where it is fleshed out, those are the parts that are rather to the US's advantage. And there are many, many things in there that the UK still wants, whether it's the steel industry or car exports or whatever. So all of this can be jeopardized by one thing that the administration takes amiss. But I think it's a sign of how strongly the UK feels about this and how strongly it feels that it has to protect its own reputation and legality that it has taken this step.
Yeah, I think the US is Britain's closest intelligence sharing partner. Clearly, we're quite dependent then on US information. It sounds as though if this did happen about a month ago and we only know about that now, at this point, the UK saying we're going to withhold that information hasn't engineered a material consequence coming back the other way.
I think that's right. You never know whether that will happen or whether it will get stacked up along with other things. But we've seen various points where the UK, and Keir Starmer has led this, has been able to depart from what the US most wanted, for example, over Diego Garcia. The US didn't particularly want the UK to hand those islands back to hand them to Mauritius. It didn't want the UK to recognise Palestine as a state. So there has been some areas where the UK has managed to operate independently of what the US most wanted. But there's a limit, and I think there is a sense in which someone in the White House, perhaps the top person, is running a calculator all the time over all these and working out whether it's tolerable or not.
At what point, yeah, the odds become stacked the other way. Bronwyn, thank you. Bronwyn Maddox, director of the Chatham House think tank. I'm reminded of that press conference where Donald Trump and Keir Starmer stood next to each other, and some of those very obvious international differences were laid out exactly over recognising Palestine, for example, by the journalists. And the two managed to disagree politely enough for the purpose of that press conference. But yes, as Bronwyn says, this is one of many sort of international disputes where we have a slightly different stance from the US.
Yes, I mean, in terms of Donald Trump standing alongside other world leaders, Keir Starmer has done particularly well, hasn't he? You know, it's like everybody's marriage of dreams by comparison to the experience that some other people have
Absolutely.
Had. Very quick one in from Kathy, and I owe you an apology because I really agree with you on this, Kathy. My dear, she says, you asked an important question about animal testing and then laughed off the bad answer. Just because your alpaca farm is safe, it really doesn't make the extremely intelligent, completely innocent rodents feel any better. After all, there is always an acceptable level of suffering until you yourself are the victim. You're spot on, Kathy. 0333 00032353. Coming up, why are we seeing so many TV shows based in Northern Ireland? All of your telly, courtesy of Scott Bryan. You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
The Evening Edition with Kate Borsay on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California campervan. Embark on an evening expedition, rounding up the latest news and previewing tomorrow's headlines. Plus, don't miss Hit the Road, your essential weekly travel guide to the best destinations across the UK and beyond. The Evening Edition, tonight from 7 on Times Radio with the new Volkswagen California campervan. Designed for every adventure. Search New Volkswagen California to find out more.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working. Wind, yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar. Know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now in bookshops, everywhere, and online.
You plan a holiday, you plan a commute. Meal plans, career plans, even workouts need a plan. So doesn't it stand to reason that your money has one too? Because the sad truth is, if it doesn't, it's just sitting there, barely growing, if at all. That's why you need a money plan. And Quilter can help. It's a lot easier to stick to than a workout plan. Money needs a plan. Quilter. Pensions, investments, advice. Find out more at quilter.com.
This is Times Radio.
It's 9 minutes to three, time for telly, and our resident TV critic Scott Bryan. There is only one big telly story in town. It's where we started our chat. I asked Scott what he thinks is next for the BBC.
In years prior, there would be quite a clear succession in terms of who could potentially take up the role, either internally or externally. But this time round, it doesn't really seem to be one. Charlotte Moore, who has been very well respected within the industry, previously the BBC's director of content, aka the person who is essentially in charge of all of the shows sort of content across the BBC. She recently sort of left to become the head of a production company elsewhere. The BBC could look to maybe potentially Alex Mahon, who runs Channel 4, but she's already been lined up to a different job. And then there's also Jay Hunt, who was known for sort of a real bit of creative renewal at Channel 4. You know, they were the people who, under her tenure, managed to get the Great British Bake Off from Channel 4, so from the BBC to Channel 4. But, I mean, I would imagine she's incredibly well paid at Apple, and also without having like the daily amount of scrutiny that a director general would have. So,
I mean, I think it's such a good point, Scott, that actually if you look at the things that ended up under the DG's gaze just in the last couple of years. MasterChef sexism, Strictly bullying, Tim Westwood, who's now been charged, Hugh Edwards, who was found guilty, Gary Lineker, who has left. Those are in no particular order of importance or horror, by the way. But, I mean, this is a job where you have got to be on your A game all of the time for so many different things that might happen. And obviously all of those things are aside from the impartiality of news, which is such a whopper at the moment.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I think, so in my sense of why, you know, the reason why Tim Davies stood down in the way was not just in relation to what's happened recently, of course, but I think he's just been worn down by this, the amount of controversies that have been faced. I mean, he was clear at the BBC annual report, which is a time where he has to face the media, and is usually the time when the BBC sort of talks about its successes. You know, he was having to sort of basically talk about, you know, the last previous months. At that time, it was, you know, just after Bob Villain and also just during the MasterChef controversy and the sacking of two presenters. And he was very clear about having a line, you know, basically saying, OK, that's it for now. Hopefully we can make a mark. And of course, we've now had this. And then I think, you know, one of the big issues is charter renewal, because every 10 years, you know, the BBC and the government would have a discussion about how much the licence fee would be for the next 10 years. And there's always a bit of stakes involved about what the future of it will be. But, you know, the government's been quite clear that the end of the licence fee is near, and there has to be alternative means of funding. So it's in the BBC's interest to have the right person in, because that could set the course for the whole BBC's future. And if the BBC chooses the wrong funding model, then that could have serious consequences for it. So it couldn't happen at a worse time, I would say, in terms of them deciding the new DG.
Completely, completely. I'm sure that we will talk more about that over the coming months and years, Scott. Let's talk about what's on our TVs at the moment. Trespassers, which is on Channel 4, isn't it, is an adaptation of an award-winning novel. Is it good?
I would say it is. I mean, I think it continues a ongoing sort of fascination with all things Northern Ireland in terms of TV making. I mean, we've had Derry Girls, which has, of course, looked at, in many ways, kind of the Northern Ireland peace process. There's also been the documentary Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland, which looks at the Troubles. And this is very much honing in, this new drama, Trespasses, is honing in about 1974, 1975, and stars Tom Cullen, Lola Pettigrew and Gillian Anderson. And it's basically about a Catholic school teacher who falls in love with a Protestant. So you see sort of the difficulty of sort of love and relationships at a very deeply divided time. I think the best thing it does is capturing the atmosphere. I think the cinematography is really rather compelling. It really feels as if you are there. I think the nuances, you know, it can be quite difficult to follow to start off with, because all of the different layers, you know, you're not given necessarily an introductory school lesson. You're sort of thrown in the middle. But in that way, you sort of learn a lot very quickly. And I thought that to be great too. And also Gillian Anderson, I think this is a fantastic role for her, a very hard role for her. I think my only hesitation is that there is quite a bit of mumbling in this. It does follow into that BBC sort of Channel 4 issue of sometimes the people sort of maybe slur their words a little. There has been quite a bit of kickback on it online, but you can easily get around that by putting the subtitles on.
Yeah. God, you would have thought that they would really look out for that now, because what with that, and do you remember it was bad lighting a couple of seasons ago, wasn't it, with Wolf Hall, where you literally had to get a spotlight out on your TV to see what was happening. Shall we talk about All Her Fault as well, which is on Now TV? I'm watching this and I am gripped by it. I think it is one of the most fantastic kind of parenting thrillers that I've ever seen, Scott.
Yeah, so, I mean, bizarrely, because of all of the stuff that's happening in regards to the BBC this week, I haven't had as much time to be watching TV as much as I would like, which feels very much a irony of the job. But I think, I mean, there's from what I've seen of it, I agree. I think also Sarah Snook, you know, who, of course, has been the heart of Succession, does a really compelling performance. And it just taps into that, like, parental fear that I think some parents do get quite put off from, you know, the idea of your child going missing and, you know, your worst realisation dream coming true. I remember Charlie Brooker, the TV reviewer, saying that, well, of course, now Black Mirror writer, saying that he's always been fearful of sort of that type of conventions because it really sort of can feel a bit too close to home. Yeah. So,
and it's a good point to make, actually, Scott. And normally I wouldn't watch something like that myself for exactly those reasons. I don't want to see played out on my television for dramatic effect my very, very worst fear. But I did read something. It was a very carefully written review of All Her Fault, which basically allays your fears without, you know, spoiling it for me or for anybody else. It literally said that you don't have to worry about your darkest, darkest fears being realised in watching this. And I think what it does very cleverly is to display this extraordinary kind of competitive atmosphere around parenting in wealthy communities, who works, who has a nanny, who's being blamed, is the husband pulling his weight, all of that type of stuff. It is so brilliantly done, it actually isn't a thriller about the disappearance of a child. It is much more a drama about all those things.
Yeah, okay. I will go, and from what I receive, I will continue and press on. You have to go out of your way for it, don't you? It's not. Is it on? So is it Sky and the streaming service now?
Yes, it is. So you absolutely do. You absolutely do. We're out of time, Scott, because we talked rightly so much about the BBC. But we will talk again next week, and I hope that you get an opportunity to watch all the TV that you want to, instead of having to read legal documents, you know, about libel cases out of Florida. I mean, these are extraordinary times in television, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, really, it is, yeah.
Yeah.
We always enjoy hearing from Scott Bryan, and he will join us again next week, and we will talk about, in fact, he wanted to talk about Kingdom, so we will make sure that we talk about that next week, next Wednesday, when he makes his appearance again.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Fee Glover and me, Rosie Wright, on Times Radio. The number of people claiming Britain's main out-of-work benefit has reached a record high. We'll be joined by Lord Bird, founder of The Big Issue. We'll find out more about how an AI-generated song has managed to top the charts. And our big guest today, Katie Prescott, The Times technology and business editor, telling us all about her new book, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch. That's all to come after the news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, Rosie. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has condemned what he calls completely unacceptable briefings against the Health Secretary. Wes Streeting has categorically denied that he was plotting to oust the Prime Minister and called for those in Number 10 briefing against him to face the sack. In PMQs earlier, the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, said the government had descended into civil war.
Unbelievably, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister's advisers have been reduced to briefing that MPs can't get rid of him, and I'm not making this up, they can't get rid of him because it would destabilise international markets. Why does the Prime Minister think that there would be a market meltdown if the Health Secretary took over?
Mr. Speaker, this is a united team and we are delivering.
A report's found decades of abuse against young men at a detention centre in County Durham were ignored and dismissed. The Independent Body for Prisons has examined what happened at Mendham Slee between 1961 and 1987, including widespread physical and sexual assaults by staff. It found extreme violence and acts of sadistic nature at the site. Adrian Usher said claims were unchallenged.
Widespread physical abuse was present from the day Mendham Slee opened its doors until the day they closed. Sexual abuse was also systemically deployed by at least two and probably more individuals.
Well, the government and Durham Police have apologised. The Prime Minister has said the BBC needs to get their house in order. It's after Donald Trump said he had an obligation to launch a $1 billion lawsuit against it. Mr. Trump said the corporation defrauded the public over the editing of a speech in a Panorama program, which made it look as if he was urging people to attack the US Capitol in 2021. Thousands of job cuts at the NHS will go ahead after £1 billion for redundancies was approved by the Treasury. The government had already announced its intention to slash 18,000 administrative and managerial roles across NHS England and the Department of Health. Wes Streeting says it'll free up funds for frontline services.
So within the next 2 years, NHS England will have been completely abolished. And over the course of the next 3 years, we will have halved those organisations. The work to reduce the size of ICBs, my department and NHS England, is beginning immediately with a voluntary redundancy programme.
Seven men have been charged with more than 40 offences against 11 teenagers after an investigation into child sexual exploitation in Bristol. The alleged offences took place between 2022 and this year. And ministers have chosen the Welsh island of Anglesey as the location for the UK's first mini nuclear power station. The small modular reactors will be built by Rolls-Royce. Sir Keir Starmer has vowed to ensure deployment of several new smaller atomic plants. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It's 3:04, so that we know that you like your politics stories and the insight provided by journalists here at The Times. And there's only one story in town today. Keir Starmer has backed his health secretary less than a day after Downing Street accused him of plotting to take over. Wes Streeting wasn't at PMQs to hear this big endorsement from his boss.
Let me be absolutely clear. Any attack on any member of my cabinet is completely unacceptable. Mr. Speaker, in relation to Health Secretary, he promised before the election that in the first year of a Labour government, we'd deliver 2 million extra appointments. We didn't deliver 2 million, or three, or four. We delivered 5 million extra appointments. And today the Health Secretary is in Manchester, where he's announcing that because of the action he's taken to abolish NHS England, he's putting more people on the front line. He's doing a great job, as is the whole of my cabinet.
Well, it was certainly raucous today, wasn't it? Wes Streeting has said that he is not interested in overthrowing Keir Starmer. He made those comments at an NHS conference in Manchester. They came after Downing Street advisers did brief multiple newspapers that he was plotting against the PM.
I've got a harder job already, so I'm quite enjoying doing this one. Thank you very much. And I'm definitely not going to say anything today that adds to the silly season going on down south.
OK, just final question on the manoeuvres that aren't. This morning on Sky News, you said that you felt that you'd been kneecapped by Downing Street in terms of the briefing.
I think I said it was the most unwarranted attack on a faithful since Joe Marler was banished in the Traitors' Final. And I think whoever's been briefing this should spend a little less time watching Celebrity Traitors and a bit more time watching Country File.
Well, back at PMQs, this was Kemi Badenoch's third question to the Prime Minister.
He says these attacks aren't authorised. That means he's lost control of Number 10, because that's where they're coming from. But the real scandal, Mr. Speaker, the real scandal is that 2 weeks from a budget, the government has descended into civil war. Yeah. Instead of fixing the mess they've made of the economy, they're all... Mr. Speaker, they're all chuntering. These are the feral MPs that Number 10 has been talking about. They're not my words. They're Number 10's words, his words. But unbelievably, Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister's advisers have been reduced to briefing that MPs can't get rid of him, and I'm not making this up, they can't get rid of him because it would destabilise international markets. Why does the Prime Minister think that there would be a market meltdown if the Health Secretary took over?
Mr. Speaker, this is a united team and we are delivering together. Look what we're doing. The fastest growth of the G7.
this is a united team. I mean, you just knew that that wasn't going to be taken with respectful silence across the benches. So nobody knows more about this story than Patrick Maguire. He wrote the story front page of the Times today. If you want the updated live page, it is available to you if you have a digital subscription. And he really gets the stories. He gets there first, and everything that he is writing about today is well worth your time. That takes us to nearly 3:08.
Now, 1 million more people are claiming out-of-work benefits without the need to look for work than a year ago. The total number of those on universal credit without seeking employment now stands at over 4 million. The big issue at the same time, which offers, you know, the publication, people experiencing homelessness and poverty a chance to earn an income by selling its magazine, say public engagement is dwindling. A new report from the organisation has found that more than half of big issue vendors' greetings go ignored. So what does that tell us about the state of poverty in Britain today and whether the system still works for those who need it most? Well, joining us now is Lord Bird, founder of The Big Issue, John Bird. A very good afternoon to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So tell us what happened when you asked the big issue sellers what kind of reception they are receiving from the general public when they're being ignored. Actually, they're not even being acknowledged.
Yeah, I mean, it's we've had this since the very beginning, but we've seen an increase in it. When we first started the big issue, people flocked to us and talked to us in because what was happening is we were giving people the chance to engage with homeless people. The problem with now is that people are so busy, they're on their phones, they're rushing around, and there is less social integration. So that is one of our problems. I ought to say to you that we also have another problem, which is the fact that people, only 1 in 20 of people who give money to a big issue vendor actually takes the paper. So you've got a situation where most of the public is turning our big issue vendors back into beggars.
Right. So what would you say if I'm listening to that thinking, gosh, I've done that, I think I'm doing the right thing by sort of giving a donation instead? You're saying really don't do that.
Well, yes, I'm saying if you do that, how the hell do you expect the big issue, which is not a charity, it's a social business, we pay tax like everybody else, how do you expect that social business to pay its wages, pay its print bill, pay its outreach team and all that? If you're not selling papers, then we don't have income from any other source, maybe some from advertising. We have something called Big Issue Recruit, which is growing and developing and is getting more and more people into employment. But that's a long, slow burn. And we also have something called Big Issue Invest. That also is about investing in social businesses. But if people are not buying the paper, not taking the paper, but giving the money, they are undermining the strength of the big issue. 2026 is going to be the toughest year in the 34 years that the big issue has been going.
Why is that the case? What are the factors contributing to it?
People don't like to take magazines as much as they used to. I mean, people used to relish the magazine. People get lots of their information on the phone. Mm. We are developing a digital magazine so that we're going to be able to say to people, all right, then you don't want the physical magazine, but here is a digital version of it. But that in itself is a recognition of the fact that the public are killing the big issue by kindness. And that is the most extraordinary thing, because the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I am not against the public supporting our vendors. I absolutely love it. But please take the paper. And if you don't want to read it, give it to someone else. Leave it on the train. I don't care.
So you're battling a couple of things there. The sort of social connectedness problem, but then also that the other issues that publishers like the Times newspaper are facing, and sort of this increasing digital world where we get our news, our features, our information. It'd be really interesting to hear from you, Lord Bird, about this effort that you have been instrumental in getting people back into work. As we hear today, that it's now over 4 million people who have been legitimately signed on to benefits. They don't need to seek work.
do you think we've got the approach right in how we are looking after those people? Or do there need to be more interventions to say, creatively, we can come up with other ways to get you back into employment?
I think it's a real problem because a lot of people who are signing on are people who have had mental health problems, a lot of it coming out of COVID and all that. I also think if you make getting social security that easy, then there will be some people who would swing the lead. I mean, I'm a perfect example. In the 60s, when you couldn't get social security, I tried desperately hard because I didn't want to work. I wanted to do other things. And so I believe very strongly that we need to make sure that if somebody can work, that they should work. And I believe very, very strongly that our children should go to school. So if parents are on social security, then one of the things they really must insist on is that their children go to school. Because if the children don't get the education, they're then going to repeat the poverty that the parents are in.
Do you think that the current benefit system we have then is too generous?
I think it's too open for abuse. I think it's too open for people who could and should be working. I'm a great believer if you are able-bodied, then you should be supporting yourself and you should be supporting your children. So I do believe that it is successive governments. This is what's happened since the days of Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher closed down so many basic industries that she doubled and trebled the cost to the government because they all got benefit. And when Lord Willie Whitelaw said to Margaret Thatcher, what are you going to do with a million people unemployed who were thrown out of the basic industries, the railways, the steelworks, the shipbuilding? She said, let them have benefit. A bit like Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake. You know, and that is when the rot started. It started way back there. And then you have generational, cross-generational unemployment and social security. There is no one going anywhere on social security. Maybe a handful of people, maybe some poets, maybe some painters are good on social security. Most people, their lives are defined by not having a reason to get up in the morning if there is no reason.
But do you think those jobs are there for those individuals, those people who would like to have a job but currently don't?
I think there are some jobs there. But, I mean, do we have to say to people, here is a job. It's not a job that you want, but it's a job that will get you up in the morning, that will get you learning skills, that will get you into the usefulness of going to work. And then you're going to get a better job if you're already in work. You're not going to get a better job if you're saying, I'm not going to do that because it's below me or whatever. I would do any job. I would do any job if I had to, if I was in a situation where if I didn't do it, I couldn't feed my children.
Yeah. OK, so you're almost saying prescribe work as an antidote and then move on to another job. I think many will say, and lots of businesses will say, some of the recent changes to last year's budget and then paying the higher rates of national insurance have meant it is difficult to take people on, which sort of brings us on to the ramifications of the budget, John, which, of course, is 2 weeks today, I think, or maybe 2 weeks tomorrow. What do you want to hear from the Chancellor? We've been speaking about sort of the welfare state. The biggest hint we've had so far in what the Chancellor is going to give rather than take away is end the two-child benefit cap. Is that right, that the right strategy?
I do believe it's the right strategy, even though the fact that I come from a family of six boys, and the more children that my mother produced, the poorer we got. So that was, and there was no social security to back us up. I think the problem is that if you have the benefit cap, you hit the child. So the child has got nothing to do with what their parents have. You know, the child inherits poverty from the parents. The child should not be punished, and therefore I'm for getting rid of the cap. But at the same time, I'm also for finding ways of making sure that people get the chance and get the encouragement to go out to work, even if the work is not of your particular liking, let's get people working and earning. And because that's the way that you get people out of poverty. Even those jobs that will keep you in poverty, it is better to be in that situation, because otherwise you've got acres and acres of idle time, which is not good for your mind. It's not good for your body. It's not good for your psychology.
I think we're very clear on the Lord Byrne manifesto for Get Back to Work. Thank you so much for your thoughts on that. Just while you're here, a couple of questions have come in about the big issue. It'd be good to hear your response. Ian has said, I've always given money to the big issue over the last 20 years. What raised my concern is there are some unlicensed people pretending to be big issue sellers when they are in fact not. They were taking advantage of the scheme. That's why I've stopped buying the paper. How much of a problem is there, John, of people fraudulently pretending to sell the big issue?
Well, that is a really interesting one. Now, I know, and I've read stories of people who use the NHS, but because it's free at the point of need, and because it's an open system, any open system is open to abuse. The big issue is free. If people come to us and say, I'm desperate, I need to make money. If I don't, I'm going to have to beg, or I'm going to have to steal, or I'm going to have to prostitute myself, or whatever else you to do. We then take them on. Unfortunately, there will be people who take the mickey. There will be people who are not genuinely homeless or in a vulnerable housing condition. We therefore, I'm not going to close down the gates just in order to catch a percentage of people who are taking the mickey. I would rather the particular person told us where this is happening, so we can send out our support team, which is a bit like a security team, and we'd go out and we would try and find whether this was true. And if it was true, we would respond to it.
Yeah, OK, thank you so much for answering that. It's been a pleasure to have you, Lord Byrne, John Byrne, founder of The Big Issue, today on why it is that so many people are not acknowledging big issue sellers and the wider sort of ramifications of what is best needed for people who are out of work, unemployed, and in this case as well, homeless too.
I thought just such an interesting point to hear Lord Byrne make, that actually you are not doing a big issue seller a favour by paying some money and then not taking the magazine. I definitely was in that camp where I thought, oh, well, I'm leaving that for them to be able to sell again. But of course, it makes perfect sense when Lord Byrne explained it's a business. So you've got to have the numbers,
the paper, yeah.
And you know, you've got to keep reading it so they can keep getting journalists to write for it and all of that type of stuff. It's Jane and Fee at Times.Radio today and every day. Coming up, has the government found a way to actually protect everybody from cyber attacks? You're listening to Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
As Downing Street builds a protective ring around Keir Starmer, will analyse reported briefings from within his cabinet. Will Wes Streeting take on Starmer for the leadership straight after the budget? Author Raphael Baer and the Conservative commentator Albie Amancona are with us to discuss the biggest stories of the day. And of course, you've got your daily dose of US politics in the Trump dump.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
Add water to your will and know that from that single drop, life will grow. Communities will flourish. A better world will be left. By leaving a gift in your will to WaterAid, you'll help bring essential clean water to people who need it, to change their own lives for generations to come. Add WaterAid to your will. Search WaterAid Legacy to find out how.
A National Book Token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a National Book Token. Buy now in bookshops, everywhere, and online.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working.
Wind,
yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you, even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar. Know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Bathrooms. The experts in design and installation. From plumbing and tiling to electrical work, the Wix Bathroom Installation Service can take care of everything. Start your journey today by booking your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Now, some very sad news in at Times Towers this afternoon. The victims' commissioner, Baroness Newlove, Helen Newlove, has died at the age of just 63 after a short illness. Her office has confirmed this news. She's been described as a committed and passionate advocate for victims. And Cathy Newman spoke to her in July last year about the pain of her husband's murder.
If you are ready for somebody, you know what's going to happen. You're kind of ready for it, but this was just something that, I've always still now, as I can feel the pain, the emotion and the sadness.
We'll have a little bit more detail about Baroness Newlove's life as we progress through the afternoon here on Times Radio, but she has died at the age of 63 after a short illness. Right, Walk My Walk by Breaking Rust is the song that is topping the Billboard's country digital sales chart in the United States right now.
Good Lord knows the man I am, and I'll die standing tall with a mic in my hand. You can kick rocks if you don't like how I talk. I'm gonna keep on talking and walk my walk. Ain't selling my soul for a seat at your table. I'm rough, I'm raw.
Well, I mean, to be honest, there are lots of questions to be asked about how that's at number one, but we're asking something completely different because it's an AI-generated song, and it marks the first time that an AI song has hit the charts right at the top. Let's talk to our resident tech journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker. Hello, Chris.
Afternoon, Fee.
Now, I don't mind a bit of country music at all. In fact, I really like it, but I just didn't think that was particularly good. Who is behind this and how has it come about? Is it a serious thing or has it been done to kind of prove something about AI?
I believe that it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I think that actually it is a serious attempt to try and top the charts, but in doing so, trying to show how this can be done in a very powerful way. So attributed to a songwriter called Aubier Rivaldo Taylor, the reality is that that is probably just either one individual who is using an AI system, or it might well be a pseudonym. Obviously, this is the first time that a song like this has topped this particular chart, although there have been around about half a dozen examples of similar types of songs created by AI that have entered the charts, albeit at lower levels, in the last few months. And I remember trying to chase down an AI band a few months ago called The Velvet Sundown that went very popular on social media because they were basically put into Spotify's recommended listening lists over the summer and became just this huge hit. They turned out to be a little bit more like mischief makers than legitimate musicians. But yeah, it seems like this is a kind of epoch-changing moment, I suppose. We're not able to distinguish it.
There's something in the streaming platforms backing AI, isn't there, that maybe we should talk about? Because if Spotify is going to put AI in its recommended list, and that is a huge, huge part of getting a hit these days, isn't it? There'll be so many artists who say, look, we've been on at you because we don't think that we're being paid enough from your streaming platform anyway. And here you are backing something that's going to make our lives even worse.
Yeah, and attitudes, I think, have changed towards this in recent months, Fee. So I remember reporting on a similar sort of story around about a year ago when it did seem as if there were people trying to effectively mechanize the production of music and not actually disclosing that this stuff was AI generated. Back then, Spotify had a pretty strident policy where they thought that wouldn't have been acceptable under their terms and conditions, but they didn't have a really easy way of distinguishing what was AI from what isn't. Now, obviously, we're starting to see people saying, well, actually, this is AI and I'm not afraid to admit it, albeit offending perhaps some musicians that are worried that is squeezing them out. But for the streamers, reality is that they don't necessarily mind if the AI is able to create music that is seen as decent enough to a decent enough number of people, then why wouldn't they have it on their systems?
Okay. We will talk about that again, I'm sure, but we've got two really interesting stories about cybersecurity and cyber attacks to talk about too. Britain is going to strengthen its laws to protect public services from potential cyber attacks. How can it do that, Chris?
Through what's called the Cybersecurity and Resilience Bill. So I know there's an awful lot happening in Parliament today, Prime Minister's questions and the aftermath of Wes Streeting and Keir Starmer, but this is still going on through parliamentary business. So this bill is designed effectively to ensure that there is a protective barrier thrown up around certain key industries, including healthcare, transport, energy and water, the sorts of things that will obviously be a bit alarming if they end up going offline because of a cyber attack. To say that actually companies that are providing services to those particular areas, so that could be IT help desk support, it could be cybersecurity, they are going to be brought under a regulator to ensure that they are keeping up to date with everything that they need to do, to ensure that they have these clear security duties that they're following, and also have the risk of being punished financially if they do misstep. So regulators will be allowed to kind of designate critical suppliers to UK essential services, and they would have to be able to shut down any gaps if there was a cyber criminal that got involved here.
Right. And the cyber insurance, this is about the cost of it. The claims tripled in 2024, according to the trade body. Eventually, Chris, does this mean that premiums will become so big it would be almost impossible to realistically insure your business against a cyber attack?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is either a risk is that you will have insurers saying, well, no, thank you, we're not going to do this, or offering just so outlandishly large sums in order to protect you through insurance that that won't be possible. Or you will start to see an awful lot of lawyers with an awful lot of magnifying glasses poring over the fine text to ensure that actually there are some ways that they cannot necessarily pay out if these things do happen. Because obviously that data, that number is huge for you. 197 million, you know, triple more than the 60 million that was paid the previous year. That was 2024, and that is obviously pre-M&S, that is pre-JLR, that is pre-whole number of big hacks that will push that number up even greater into 2025. At the same time as well, with this government announcement, they put out some independent research that suggested the average cost of a significant cyber attack in the UK is around about, on average, £190,000 damage to the organisation. So big impacts here for offline and online as well.
Chris, it's always good to talk to you. Just before you go, we're going to spend the next half an hour of the programme talking to Katie Prescott about her book, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch. Mm. Now, not everybody listening will know who Mike Lynch was and what he did. They might, unfortunately and tragically, know about how he and his daughter and some of his friends died. But can you just put into context, as a person who really knows the technical world, his relevance and importance?
Yeah, he was absolutely enormous. So he obviously oversaw this company called Autonomy that was sold to Hewlett-Packard for more than £10 billion. And that became a quite a controversial deal. Mike Lynch really went through the ringer legally with this sort of stuff. And Katie's book sounds really interesting, really exciting. I also found it fascinating that she herself seemed to use AI in part of the research to pour through all of the legal documentation that has gone through Mike Lynch's life, trying picking out those patterns, those little details that really bring her book to life. So I will be, for one, listening on.
Thank you for your loyalty and dedication. It is a mutual path, Chris. That is our resident tech journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker.
So up next will be Katie Prescott, the Times Technology Business Editor, telling us the tale of the improbable life and death of a tech billionaire. All of that to come, but at 3:31, let's get a check on the latest news headlines with Eliza Phillips.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thanks, Rosie. Good afternoon. Democrats in the US have released emails which they say link Donald Trump to the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. They say they were provided by the Epstein estate. One email alleges that Donald Trump spent hours with a victim. President Trump has consistently denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein and has previously called the allegations against him a hoax. Sir Keir Starmer's denied authorising a number 10 attack on his health secretary, who's been engulfed by rumours he's planning a leadership coup. The Prime Minister insists his team is united, while Wes Streeting says the whispers are like scenes from Celebrity Traitors. Labour MP for Derby North, Catherine Atkinson, is backing the PM.
This is a distraction on what everyone needs to be pulling together to do. But I haven't seen any politicians who have come out saying that this is anything other than a united and stable government. And that is hugely important when we live in globally such uncertain times.
A report's found decades of abuse of young men at a detention centre in County Durham was ignored and dismissed by the prison service, police and government. It says victims were groomed and attacked at Medamsley. A five-year-old boy has died after 2 days after being injured by a collapsing wall at a golf park in southeast London. The child was flown to hospital on Sunday after the incident at Sidcup Family Golf. And Victims Commissioner Baroness Helen Newlove has died after a short illness. Her office called her a passionate advocate for victims. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now in bookshops, everywhere, and online.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead. Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens. Choose Wix for your new kitchen and then sit back and relax, knowing it's filled with products that are reassuringly backed up with guarantees. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's 25 to 4. Now, it sounds like the plot to almost a sort of TV series, Succession style, with just extraordinary odds. It's the story of the technology giant dubbed the British Bill Gates. This is Mike Lynch, who built a billion, multi-billion pound technology empire. He ended up extradited to the US in handcuffs, arrested on suspicion of fraud, facing life in jail with facing only a 0.4% chance of an acquittal in those circumstances. Now, that was a trial he ended up winning. But in celebrating his victory, on his yacht off the coast of Sicily, that was the Bayesian, it sunk in a freak storm, taking his life. His co-defendant was the same weekend killed in a car accident in the UK. Now, the odds of both of those deaths occurring on the same weekend were estimated to be 4 in 1 billion. Lots of people have been searching for conspiracy. The fact, actually, is it's just tragically sad. Documenting the story has been Katie Prescott, the technology business editor of The Times, in her new book, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch. And Katie is in the studio with us this afternoon. Katie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Congratulations on the book as well. I think we could do with starting with just a reminder, really, or an introduction to who Mike Lynch is, because I think when we think tech pioneer. We think of this sort of introverted character squirreling away in their bedroom, and he was quite the opposite in terms of his personality.
Yes, that's right. So, you talked about the story being improbable. I'd say everything about Mike Lynch's life was improbable. He was born to a relatively poor background in Essex, an Irish family. His mother was a nurse and his father was a fireman. He was born without fingerprints. So it was one of the first things that I found was sort of extraordinarily unlikely. It's a very, very rare condition.
Do you know what? None of our listeners were expecting that, Katie.
No. and it comes into the story later on, actually, in his first business. But he was extraordinarily bright and a very, very gifted child, but not, as you say, the sort of introverted person who didn't have friends. Far from it, actually. He was a very lively child, very, very curious, liked doing things, sort of taking an alarm clock apart to see how it worked, a voracious reader.
Loved playing the clarinet with his cheeks really puffed out.
And a terrific musician. And he won a scholarship to a private school where he really excelled. And very early on, his teachers, his school friends told me, had him mapped out as really one of the brilliant boys of his generation. I say boys, they let in girls later on, but certainly in his year. And then he went on to Cambridge, where he started off studying natural sciences and then moved into engineering, into a branch of engineering called signal processing, basically looking at patterns in audio and images. As you say, he loved playing the clarinet and he was passionate about music and led bands both while he was at school but also at Cambridge. And his first foray into tech was really into music technology. So if you think about how music sounded in the 80s, kind of the sort of use of synthesizers and stuff, that was where Mike Lynch started getting into tech. But his first business when he left Cambridge was developing fingerprint scanning for the police force. And his business partners at the time said it was quite annoying because you couldn't use Mike to test the technology. And this is really where I think you start to see him as something of an outlier. When you look at a lot of people who left, so he was at Cambridge in the 80s, a lot of really bright people who wanted to get ahead and make money went into the city where the big bang was happening. The opening up of financial regulation and people were making a fortune. But Mike was always passionate about science and doing something that was actually practical and that would really change the world. And so he decided to stay at Cambridge to do a PhD. And that's where he got into the business world, working in a very, very early sort of business startup center before these things really existed in Cambridge. And that's really the genesis of his big company, Autonomy.
He rode the sort of wave of development of technology, the dot-com boom. And one thing that helped him was not just his intelligence, was his creative storytelling. And you have so many examples here from friends, colleagues that you've spoken to about how he would just, it was more than exaggerate, wasn't it? He would sort of, in some cases, completely fabricate things, but then also believed his own lies.
I think it was quite a difficult book to write in many ways, because certainly the picture and the stories that Mike projected to the world when I read interviews, it often transpired, were exaggerated when I spoke to people close to the story. He was remarkable because he was able, I think, to understand technology, but also marketing in a way that very, very few people can. And so that was, I think, the genesis of the success of his business, is that he could see how tech could become a bigger story. I think you often find with entrepreneurs that storytelling is a big part of what they do, is a sort of fake it till you make it thing. And Mike certainly had that in spades. I mean, one of the early stories I was told was that he made up a finance director in his business called Frank Bridges. So if anyone phoned up and wanted to speak to Frank, the whole team would know that it was about an invoice or something. But it just became a bit of an in-joke. And that was an early example of this sort of exaggeration. But as you start to look at the business and how it grew further on, we found more and more examples of that, yeah.
Can I just ask you, Katie, how autonomy would have touched us? So we often hear about these big companies that got massive valuations, astonishing figures, and you think, OK, but where did I meet that? You know, where's the kind of Heinz baked beans interaction in my life? What did it do for us?
It's a great question. And actually, most of us probably wouldn't have encountered it because it was a business-to-business organisation. But it essentially did corporate search. So it would search through unstructured data, things like emails and voicemails and anything that wasn't put into neat databases. And they sold their software to everyone from governments. The BBC was a customer, the Financial Services Authority. So big organisations were using their software, but it's not the sort of thing that you would have seen advertised on the telly. It's,
I mean, interesting. He did brag, didn't he, that he thought it could have been as big as Google.
Yeah, so because he developed this search technology in the 1990s, so just at the cusp of the dot-com boom, he said that had he applied it to all of us and made it for the consumers, it could have been the next Google. I mean, personally, I think that was really an exaggeration. He blamed tech analysts at the time for saying that the consumer model wasn't working. That's why he went down the corporate route. But it seems, given how forceful he was as a character and how ruthless, that's unlikely.
We'll get onto the fraud accusations and then sort of the tragic end of this story in a moment or two. But from your personal perspective, trying to tell this story, there were lots of complications. First of all, because obviously he's only recently died, but also these rumours going around autonomy of people saying Katie Prescott's dangerous. What happened?
So it's interesting you said congratulations at the beginning about the book being published, because in some ways I don't feel a huge amount of joy in it. It was an incredibly difficult book to write, and I didn't just start writing it after his death. I wanted to tell the story of how Hewlett-Packard bought his business autonomy. A year later, he was fired and accused of fraud, and there was this enormous fallout, a decade of litigation, and far more court cases than the final California one. However, when he died, clearly that just added a horrible tragedy to the story. So it was very, very difficult to write in the aftermath of his death. He had a small cohort of people who were very, very close to him, who clearly were grieving just this extraordinary, dreadful thing to happen, most of whom as well knew Stephen Chamberlain, the vice president of finance, who was killed that same weekend. And then a lot of people who had crossed Mike over the years, and he was a very difficult character and could be very abrasive. And as one of those very close to him said to me, you know, people never really forgot the scars of their encounter with Mike. But people were unwilling to speak ill of the dead. And I really noticed that a couple of months into the project, that started to thaw. The fear, and I think there was a lot of fear around Mike, started to melt away, and people were much more willing to speak. So in the end, I spoke to more than 100 people for the book. Since it's been serialised in the Times, I've been inundated with people who've also been contacting me about their experiences.
I think we need to try and explain, don't we, the elements of fraud, the tribunals and the cases in all of this, because you say Mike Lynch to people, and I think genuinely most people don't know what to make of the different verdicts that had been passed down in different places.
It's incredibly, incredibly complicated. So if we start perhaps with the British civil trial, do we want to go back to the sale to HP? I don't know. Maybe that's a...
I think start with the civil trial. And,
okay.
And in a nutshell, sort of encapsulate that he kept getting into legal difficulties throughout his career.
Well, so Hewlett-Packard bought Autonomy for $11 billion. And then after Mike Lynch was fired, a whistleblower came forward. And I should say a whistleblower had also come forward to Autonomy a few years previously and spoke to HP about some queries they had with the accounts. And that led to HP starting an investigation. And then there was this completely unprecedented situation where the chief executive, Meg Whitman, accused Mike of fraud without him realizing that this was coming. And at that point, HP said that they were going to sue Autonomy. They sued Mike Lynch and his chief financial officer, who was a good friend of his from Cambridge, called Sushovan Hussain. This finally came to trial in the UK, and you realise how painful lawsuits are when you read this book. So the fraud was declared, as it were, in 2012. It came to trial in 2019. And there was this incredibly long and complex trial. And at the end of it, the judge took 2 years to come to a verdict, but categorically found that there was fraud at Autonomy and went through it transaction by transaction, an experienced chancery judge here. And at that point, Mike Lynch, who'd been fighting extradition to America, his chief financial officer at this point had been put in prison for the fraud. So he'd gone through a criminal trial. And the Department of Justice were pursuing Mike for the same thing. And Priti Patel signed the form for his extradition, and he was sent to the States. So when you talked about the probability of him being found guilty in his trial in California, you can see that, especially given all of the verdicts that had come before, it certainly was what everybody presumed would happen.
And you were at, I think it was the Times summer party, when the news came through to say he's been found not guilty.
Yes, and I just...
And you were stunned.
My phone buzzing. We had, in the way that journalists often do, pre-written a story and explain a story about what had gone on, I'm afraid, with a top that sort of had a presumption of a guilty verdict. I should say as well, the Financial Reporting Council, Britain's accounting watchdog, had also found evidence of fraud at Autonomy and fined Deloitte over the auditing of their accounts. So it just felt like there was this mountain of evidence against them. And I ran to find my editor, Richard Fletcher, the business editor of the Times, and told him, and he couldn't believe it. I mean, he's been a business editor for a very long time and has followed the Lynch case. And I think everyone in the Lynch camp and the lawyers would tell you they were astonished as well. I mean, it was really a shock verdict from the jury.
Did he have many, many friends or anyone sort of coming out to defend him who hadn't been paid to do that?
Yeah, he had got a very close group of friends who had worked with him through Autonomy and who stayed with him after the sale to Hewlett Packard and after he was fired, and went and formed a fund to invest in new businesses. The judge in the British civil case called the people at the top of Autonomy a cabal, and there was certainly very much an inner circle around Mike. People described it to me as like a bunker mentality, you know, like you're on the team or off the team.
Yeah.
And it was very like that.
You get this verdict that has sort of stunned the technology world, the business world. It's not what you were anticipating. I think maybe not him either. They have this then celebration, which brings us up to the absolutely tragic accident, just a real freak accident, this storm that seemingly came out of nowhere. Remind us of what happened.
There had been a series of yacht trips that summer where Mike was bringing together people who'd really worked with him and supported him through the past decade through these cases. And on board the particular trip, which ended in tragedy, was Chris Morvillo, who was his longstanding US attorney, well-known New York lawyer from a big family of New York lawyers, his wife, a chap called Jonathan Bloomer, who was the chair of Mike's audit committee at Autonomy right at the very end of the business, and his wife, his daughter Hannah, and Mike Lynch's wife Angela, and a few others. And they had just heard the news about Stephen Chamberlain being hit by a car, Mike's co-defendant in the US trial, not someone he was particularly close to at Autonomy, but their lives became entwined in this extraordinary trial. Steve was living in a small Airbnb out in San Francisco, not too far from Mike. So their lives had become entwined by this.
In case you remind us how he died.
He was out running in Cambridgeshire and he was hit by a car. And the lady stopped and he ended up having to go to hospital in Addenbrookes. And that's where he died. So they'd found out on the yacht about the accident. So the mood was pretty bleak, as you can imagine. They knew a storm was coming that evening. They were leaving the next day. They were flying out of Palermo, the capital of Sicily. And so the captain decided to moor the boat in a sheltered area to weather the storm. But early in the morning, the boat was hit by an enormous gust of wind and tipped over in 15 seconds. And those in the cabins below, including Mike and his daughter Hannah, drowned, which it was just absolutely awful.
Yeah, unbearable to think about. And actually, it was almost unbelievable for the people who were there. They couldn't believe how quickly that yacht just literally disappeared under the waves. You had to comb through many sort of conspiracy theories to try and tell this story, because that is something so unfathomable to say. Well, those two individuals both died in freak accidents the same weekend.
And the weekend itself is really odd, because it was the 18th of August, which was the date that Hewlett-Packard had bought Autonomy and was forever known within Hewlett-Packard as 818, which is this sort of terrible day for the company. Mm. So it was extraordinarily strange. I have not found any evidence that this was anything other than two dreadful and completely improbable accidents. I think if you look at any of the evidence, you know, you can't find anything, but I can see why people's brains jump to conspiracy theories.
You finished the book by saying sort of his life serves as a warning and an inspiration. Why? Why did you come to that conclusion?
One of the saddest things I found writing this book was that Mike was obviously so completely brilliant in so many ways, and he did not need to push the envelope, as so many people have described it to me, when it came to the accounting of his company. I really grappled with the fraud, I have to say. He always denied it. But I think when you look at the evidence and when you speak to people and you look at what happened in the civil trial, it's pretty clear. And I haven't actually found anyone who said it wasn't now, looking back all those years, that they were fiddling with the accounts, but they didn't need to. It wasn't a failing company. And so I always found that very, very sad, because he created so many successes, which I think is when I talk about his legacy. You look at some of the businesses that he invested in the wake of that terrible HP takeover. And by the way, I don't think HP are completely blameless in this situation either, but that's another story. He backed a company called Darktrace, which is a cybersecurity company that got sold for billions last year to a US business. A company called Featurespace, which is really early to financial services AI, and a legal AI business. And so it is very sad to think, you know, coming back to the UK, what he might have created. I should also say, though, this is one of these stories which still hasn't finished. So the lawyers in this case are getting together again in a few weeks' time to finally decide how much Lynch's estate has to pay Hewlett-Packard. Earlier this year, they ruled that it should be a judge ruled that it should be £700 million. That doesn't include interest. Mm. And that was in 2011.
Right. Mm. So I think that Anne, one of our listeners, sums everything up about this story, saying, how can anyone believe that the death of Mike Lynch and his co-defendant were just coincidence? Saying it's just tragically sad isn't an answer. People aren't going to buy that.
And how do you create a store, man?
That is the huge problem, and why your title is so perfect, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch, because it doesn't matter. You're a forensic journalist. It doesn't matter how much fact you find. That coincidence just will always make people think that something else happened here.
I just don't. How do you create a storm and try and hit a specific person?
I don't know.
I mean, just anyway, that's a terrible, horrible question.
But it is just one of those cases, isn't it? One of those stories where we cannot get our head around everything that happened, the avenues of that man's life. I mean, it's like a burglar comes into your house and takes the TV, the phone, the washing machine, but it's not a burglary. That's what happened with the company too. It is remarkable. It's a story beautifully told. Thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you. It's good to see you both.
It's been a pleasure flicking through it. The improbable life and death of a tech billionaire, The Curious Case of Mike Lynch, and it is out now. Katie, thank you so much.
It is 4:04. It's Fee Glover and Rosie Wright on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's Essential Morning Briefing, with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
A national book token gives a world of discovery, where imaginations run wild with endless possibility. They might choose a voyage to stars and black holes, or to relive their team's most legendary goals, to learn how to draw, to grow, to bake, or scare themselves silly and stay wide awake. From the depths of love to the depths of the ocean, give a gift beyond words. Give a national book token. Buy now in bookshops, everywhere, and online.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective, and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth, and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote, and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Some people think solar only works in summer, but at Hive, we're here to show you solar works all year round, no matter the weather.
Like heavy rain, still working.
Wind,
yep, still working. Sleet that's basically sideways, you guessed it, still working.
Power is getting the sun to work for you even in winter, helping you to cut your bills and lower your footprint, putting you in control of your energy. Search Hive Solar. Know your power.
Can I come down now?
Performance varies by season, weather, roof and system size.
This is Times Radio.
Another Kate has messaged in, not Katie Prescott, who we've just been talking about, to say, I am with Anne, another sceptic to work out how it is that those two men died the same weekend in freak accidents.
And when Katie said it was 18-8, you know, which is a significant date for a Hewlett-Packard.
You think the conspiracy theorist alarm is going off. So you can, well, you can read the book for yourself, Kate and Anne, and work out, you know, Katie has done so much. Over 100 people that she spoke to, and as she said, that was not easy because many people were nervous to talk to her. It's been a pleasure. We will be back this time tomorrow as well at 2 o'clock. Of course, John Pienaar is next. Tomorrow, Petula Clark.
Jane has done an interview with Petula Clark, our pet. She's 93 years old now and she's got a memoir out, so we shall look forward to that. Our producer today was Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And the book is called The Curious Case of Mike Lynch by Katie Prescott. And as she said so clearly during the interview, it's also a story of immense sadness for so many people because of the way it ended. Up next, John Pienaar with Drive. Enjoy your evening when you get to it.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you. Thank you. Good to have you with us today. Good to talk to you today. Thank you so much, Rosie. It's me, John Pienaar, now at 4 o'clock with Times Radio Drive. And here are the headlines. American congressmen have published new emails. They say link the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein to President Trump. And Keir Starmer says the attacks on the health secretary are completely unacceptable. Coming up, I'll be talking to the health minister, Karen Smyth. And what difference does the UK stopping intelligence sharing with the US in the Caribbean make to the president's so-called war on drug traffickers?
This is Times Radio.
And other news with Eliza Phillips.
Thanks, John. Good afternoon. Private emails sent by Jeffrey Epstein have been released by the Democrats, who say they link Donald Trump to the paedophile. In one, Epstein alleges the US president knew about the girls. Mr. Trump has called allegations against him a hoax and has previously denied any knowledge of Epstein's crimes or wrongdoing. The White House says the emails have been selectively leaked to create a fake narrative. Sir Keir Starmer said he did not authorise briefings against his cabinet. It's as he faced Prime Minister's questions amid speculation over his future as leader.
Mr. Speaker, he's talking about growth and investment. While the Prime Minister desperately tries to cling on to his own job, perhaps he understands what it's like for all those people out there losing their jobs. How can he talk about growth? Yesterday, we learned that unemployment has risen to the same rate as it was in lockdown. 180,000 jobs lost, Mr. Speaker. Why does the Prime Minister think that unemployment has risen every single month since Labour took office?
Well, that was the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, but Sir Keir Starmer defended the government's record on tackling unemployment.
Let me give the House the details. 329,000 people more are in work since the start of this year. So 329,000 more are in work. Of course I accept we need to do more in relation to unemployment.
Decades of abuse of thousands of young men by staff at a County Durham detention centre were ignored and dismissed by the prison service, police and Home Office. That's a main finding by the prison ombudsman after looking into the Mendemsley Detention Centre. The sexual and physical abuse took place between 1961 and 1987. Eric Sampson was sent there aged 17.
The violence I had done to me was terrible. The amount of times I was knocked about, every day was hell on earth. Every day and night was hell on earth for the full 9.5 weeks. With all the abuse and obviously the sexual abuse I had done to us, it totally ruined my life.
Durham police have apologised and say victims remain the primary concern. Thousands of job cuts at the NHS will go ahead after £1 billion for redundancies was approved by the Treasury. The government had already announced its intention to slash 18,000 administrative and managerial roles across NHS England and the Department of Health. West Reading says it'll free up funds for frontline services.
So within the next 2 years, NHS England will have been completely abolished. And over the course of the next 3 years, we will have halved those organisations. The work to reduce the size of ICBs, my department and NHS England, is beginning immediately with a voluntary redundancy programme.
And military driving examiners will be drafted in to help cut the huge waiting lists for practical tests. Ministers are changing the booking regulations to tackle unfair practices that allow people to resell driving tests for profit. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Well, Keir Starmer would obviously much rather we listened and thought more about his plans to tackle the country's enormous problems than chatter about his leadership. Of course he would. Lord knows the country's problems are big enough. Trouble is, the chatter about his leadership and now ferocious attacks from his own senior advisers on close colleagues that they suspect are plotting against him have grown so loud it's hard to think at all.
Any attack on any member of my cabinet is completely unacceptable.
And that is what the Prime Minister told MPs in the Commons. Well, perhaps he should tell his advisers that. The Tory leader cheekily named his Chief of Staff Morgan McSweeney. Unless he knew about it, of course. In which case, surely Starmer's position is impossible. Even more impossible. And yes, I know that is a logical impossibility. And from all we hear about the hemorrhage of support for the Prime Minister among Labour MPs, it's hard to avoid the thought that Keir Starmer's best hope of surviving a leadership battle now is by not having one. And the extraordinary bout of brief against potential rivals in general and the Health Secretary, West Reading in particular, just made a leadership challenge that much more likely and not less. I wonder what you are thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times, or a tweet to at Times Radio. Do tell me what is on your mind. So, speaking to the BBC this morning, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, was asked if those responsible for the briefing about what he called categorically untrue rumours about his leadership manoeuvrings should be sacked.
Yes. But, you know, he's got to find them first. And I wouldn't expect him to waste loads of time on this.
Now, Prime Minister's questions, the Conservative Party leader, Kemi Badenoch, which he brought up, Wes Streeting.
The Health Secretary said there is a toxic culture in Downing Street that needs to change. He's right, isn't he? Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, my focus each and every day is on rebuilding and renewing our country. But let me be absolutely clear, any attack on any member of my cabinet is completely unacceptable. And the Health Secretary, Mr. Speaker, in relation to Health Secretary, he promised before the election that in the first year of a Labour government, we'd deliver 2 million extra appointments. We didn't deliver 2 million, or three, or four. We delivered 5 million extra appointments. And today the Health Secretary is in Manchester, where he's announcing that because of the action he's taken to abolish NHS England, he's putting more people on the front line. He's doing a great job, as is the whole of my cabinet.
Keir Starmer at question time. Now, the Conservative leader went on to question the role of those in the Prime Minister's top team.
These attacks came from number 10, nowhere else, his toxic number 10. The person responsible for the culture in number 10 is his chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney. Does the Prime Minister have full confidence in him?
No. Morgan McSweeney, my team and I are absolutely focused on delivering for the country. And let me be clear, of course, Mr. Speaker, I've never authorised attacks on Cabinet members. I appointed them to their post because they're the best people to carry out their jobs. And Mr. Speaker, she asks about waiting lists. Waiting lists are down under this government. The number of GPs is up. And because we've scrapped NHS England, we're investing on the front line. That's what the Health Secretary is doing today, getting on with his job, and he's doing a very good job too.
The Tory leader had this assessment.
Since they came in, it's been disaster after disaster. The Deputy Prime Minister, the new Deputy Prime Minister, is clueless about how many illegal migrant sex offenders he's let loose. The Culture Secretary, breaking the rules to give her donor a top job. Taxes set to rise even further. Unemployment at levels not seen since lockdown. And in the middle of it, a weak Prime Minister at war with his own cabinet. Mr. Speaker, it's not just him, it is all of them. There is no replacement, it is all of them. 2 weeks before the budget, isn't it the case that this Prime Minister has lost control of his government, he's lost the confidence of his party, and lost the trust of the British people?
Yeah! Mr. Speaker, the stupid mistakes were made over 14 long years. They broke the economy, and now they